See, God can only have fellowship with those who are like him. That's why people will be lost for eternity if they are not holy. And the in fact, 2 Corinthians 5:21 says that God made him, that is Christ, to be sin for us, who are sinful, in order that we might be made the righteousness of God in him, in Christ, not in ourselves, in Christ. But those who are redeemed by the cross are redeemed for the purpose of sanctification, which is simply the doctrine that we are to be progressively conformed to the image of Christ. And last night we quoted Romans 8:29, that those whom God foreknew, he predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son. Jesus came that he might bring many sons to glory. That word glory means to the character of God. We are to be holy. Why? For he is holy. So that the primary purpose of the church is not evangelism. That is secondary. That flows from the primary purpose. The church is in the business of being conformed to the image of Christ. And that means many things. It means the church will be many things. It means the church will do many things. And this is why elders are to... It's what the qualifications that we studied last night mean. I'm summarizing last night's lesson. The qualifications, as we read those in Timothy, that's simply a profile of men who are perhaps ahead of many others in this on the journey of becoming like God. The elders are to be that kind of person described in Paul's letter to Timothy, because the elders are to lead the church along the pathway of righteousness, that is, progressively being conformed to the image of Christ. And the biblical plan is that when a new Christian is born in the family of God, that Christian begins the process of being progressively conformed to the image of Christ. Because the whole purpose in creation was that God would have fellowship with those like him. Now, that is the basic teaching on the qualifications of an elder, and of course by implication the qualifications of a deacon. Finishing, the deacons are to be also those who are farther along than most or many in this path. We come now to what we learned by looking at the biblical names, and I'm just going to look at this very briefly. The biblical names for the elder. The word deacon simply means servant. We all know that. And if we have time to get to that, I will. But let me look at some of the names in the New Testament given to the office of elder and see what they suggest. We understand what kind of men they are to be, why this kind of man is to be chosen. Not a perfect man. There are no perfect men. Why men who can lead the church closer, progressively, year by year, to the likeness of Christ. Now, as I taught last week during this Bible school hour, I gave a brief history of the development of church polity, how that the church in the first century was the collegiate eldership, a plurality of elders over one church. In the second century, you had one elder over one church, and they called him the bishop, or like maybe they call him the pastor. And they had one elder over over many churches. And then finally, the papacy is simply one elder over the whole church, called the Pope. And as we got to that, it took about 500 years to actually develop, but that's how it got that way. But while in the second century, many areas of the church, and this was pretty well universal by the end of the second century, the term bishop was used to apply to this one ruling man. In the New Testament, and it's very clear from early church history, in the first century, for the first generation or two of the church, the word bishop was simply synonymous with the word elder. This office is called elder. That's the term we normally use. And as the name suggests, it simply means older. 1 Timothy 4:14, the Greek word is theonistic, it's presbyteros. The word presbyterian comes from this. They were simply older men. What does that suggest to you? Experience, right. It suggests maturity, does it not? Now, let me say a word about this. I don't have time to go into all this, but in the first century world, and by the way, through most of the history, In most of the history of the world, in most places, older people were respected in a way that older people are not respected in our culture. It's very unfortunate. Today, we worship youth. Youth is good, old is bad. And if you get old, you try to look young. you lie about your age, whatever. And the women do too. And by the way, that shows that our civilization is losing its faith, losing its soul. But in past times, it was generally understood that a man who was older, all other things being equal, would very likely have something to teach younger people. And they say experience is the best teacher. That's not the worst teacher. Tuition's too high. And usually the lesson is learned too late. But experience is a good teacher. Listen to me. Experience is a good teacher if it's someone else's experience. We're usually too proud to learn much from somebody else's experience. And I recommend, I always try to teach the boys at Central Florida Bible College that to find some older preacher and just spend some hours with him, take him out to eat, and say that to him. Now, what would you tell me, you having been through it? See what I'm saying? Well, and so the church has no business of being like the world in this. Just because the world looks down on the elderly, the church has no business doing that. Now, it does not mean just because a person is older that he's smarter. Some are and some aren't. Some get, you know, I say like with kids, some kids grow up and some just get big. And some people, as they age, get wise, others just get old. Got that? So doesn't just follow. So elder is not the only term used, but that is suggestive. And it does not just mean, it means old in years. Older means older. For instance, this is a matter of opinion, but I'm very reluctant to vote for a man for the eldership before he's 40 years old myself. Once in a while, you'll find somebody in his 20s and 30s who's mature enough to do it. Very often you find it. I didn't say I didn't vote. I have voted, but I'm reluctant to. Why? Most of the time, you have to be 40 years old before you begin to see some things as they really are. Now, you may not agree with that, and you may be right. That's just an opinion. The next word is, he's to be a bishop, episkopos, and the word episcopal comes from this, and which simply means an overseer. An overseer, a foreman, we would say. Very close to our word foreman, one who has to see that something gets done. The next word, poimen, if you're interested, is the word shepherd, very common word. Act 20, Paul says to the elders from Ephesus that he meets down at Miletus, he says, shepherd the flock. And Peter says that the elders are not to, he's a fellow shepherd there. And the elders, because the elders are to be shepherds, not to lord it over the flock, but they're to shepherd it. There's a difference between driving the flock and leading the flock. The shepherd suggests much about the office of elder, doesn't he? He's responsible to protect the flock, to lead the flock, but to care for the flock. And Jesus often pictured, and I think it's instructive that Jesus pictured God in Luke 15. I preached on this a couple of 3 weeks ago, like a good shepherd who has 99 in the, if you come home and the one does not come home, and what does he do? He leaves the 99 in the wilderness and goes after the one that didn't come home. There's this loving concern. By the way, I can't prove this, but I think the reason God, through the Holy Spirit, inspired many names for the eldership is that you need a balance. For instance, if you just say older, if you call elder and nothing else, that might suggest that as long as a man is 50 or 60 years old, he can be an elder. But it's more than that, see. If you just said overseer, that and nothing else, it might leave the impression that, well, he's just a boss. And that isn't true. And so you add the word shepherd. It sort of mixes these together. It sort of blends these in. And shepherd is many things. A shepherd is a very, you see, the word overseer is kind of a negative term. If I say the word foreman, sometimes you may have had some experiences that that would cause that word to be sort of a, as the experts say, a pejorative or a negative, a snarl word. Foreman. Oh, yeah, I know foreman. Let me tell you about some foremans I've known. But the word shepherd, you see, is a very positive term. It suggests gentle, loving care. Does that make sense to you? Like I said, I don't know why. I'm just guessing as to why God used it. There was no one name which was an official name, you see. We were sort of selected elders, but there's no reason for it. Elders, Titus 1:7, elders are referred to as stewards. What's a steward? One who's responsible for that which belongs to another. The man would own property, he would leave a steward in charge, and he would go his way. The steward would have to give an account. The steward had authority over that property, over the servants, but the farm didn't belong to him. It belonged to his master. A steward is one who, they call giving often. We use the word stewardship for giving. We have a stewardship month, which means we think about and pray about and study about how we're going to handle that which does not belong to us. And listen, many elders forget that they're stewards on behalf of Christ. And deacons and preachers forget that. We act like the church is ours. It's not a church at all. It's the Lord's church. Sometimes we say, come to my church, and I know what we mean. We mean the church I go to, the church to which I belong. There's nothing wrong with that. Sometimes we say my church, and we mean it. You're not going to do that. Watch, my church. God help the church that falls under the private possession of an elder or a group of elders, anybody else. Sometimes I've seen churches owned by people who aren't even in church office. You don't have to be an officer to own a church or to think you own it. And so elders will always remember that they are stewards, as well as deacons and preachers and anybody else. They're stewards. And we're going to have to give them see, implicit in the word stewardship is, and the Bible emphasizes this a number of times, we've spent a long time studying this, how that a major element in stewardship is accountability. The master comes back, and the steward has to give an account for how he handled that which is not his. Let me say this to you. Remember I said last night, I'm for the elders. I've worked with elders, and I've worked with some who were great elders, and I've worked with some who had a long way to go. You don't always agree with them, but I've formed. And one of the things you must realize that it's a great motive for our praying for our eldership. To realize that these fellows don't have to give an account for how they do their job. Now, it doesn't mean they're going to be lost if they didn't do a perfect job. That's not what I'm saying. But it means they're going to have, whatever's involved in it, they're going to have to answer to God. But we all are, aren't we? We all have to answer to God. You know, I've kidded. It seems like every place I go, somebody turns on a tape recorder. I have nightmares about my coming to judgment. Here's all these tapes, all these things I've ever said. And the Lord said, the Lord saying, oh, you remember you said this, and he said to make me listen to all the lousy things I said. All the things I said, which I hadn't said, but they're on tape. So everything you say is on tape. Everything you do is on tape. And that's what we're going to have to answer for. And what that means is that I, you know, it's easy to criticize leaders. We've got no business spending any more time and energy criticizing leaders than we have praying for them. And I think if most churches spent more time praying and less time criticizing, we'd have better leaders, better preachers, better deacons, better elders, better Bible school teachers. But human nature sort of makes us, you know, we sort of criticize from the hips. And I do that. I'm guilty of that. I'm not trying to accuse you of anything. It's easy, isn't it? National leaders, it's so easy to criticize. They don't need to realize that these men have a stewardship. To pray for them. They're to be teachers. 1 Timothy 3:2, Ephesians 4. Elders are to be teachers. Titus 1:9 through 11. We're not going to take time to read all these scriptures. You have them available to you. But they are to be teachers. One of the qualifications is apt to teach. That means, among other things, that the elder cannot just be a good man. He must be a man who knows the gospel, who knows what the church is about. Now, this is a real sore point with many people, especially immature Christians or new Christians, or just people. We're all guilty of all these things. That Well, a great deal of damage can be done to the church when elders and deacons are put in office who are good moral men, good Christian men, devout men, good fathers, maybe good leaders in the community, maybe good businessmen, but who are not skilled in the gospel, who do not really have a mature understanding of the gospel. The reason an elder must be after people is the church is not like a civic or a social organization. The church is a very specialized body. It has a very specialized job. It's not simply a group of hail fellow, well-met people. They're going to get together and have a good time. Now, I say that, a lot of people think that. It's very common because, especially in America, we have so many voluntary organizations. America is known for that. In fact, you study 19th century intellectual history, you find that there were hundreds and hundreds, or thousands of voluntary organizations. And Americans, every time somebody said, if you get three Americans and stand on a desert island before they were there now, they'd elect a president, vice president, and recording secretary. And some of you remember that. We live in a little old town that I was born. You're being kind in calling it a town. And it had an Oddfellows Hall when I was a little boy, and they had several organizations. They had enough people to go in, but they had more organization than they had people just about. Everybody forms a club in America. It's been the way. And there's nothing wrong with that. And we had a society, a mutual aid society in Hamilton, where I preached, called the Monkey Aid Society. Of all things to call it. They get together, with a mutual aid, they put together and have insurance policies, and they're nice. I don't know what they did, but I could have thought of a better name than that. The Monkey Mutual Aid Society. Well, as I say, there's nothing wrong with that, and a lot of good is done. And these organizations do a lot of good. I'm not putting them down. All I'm saying is that the church is not like that. And the temptation is for Americans who are so used to forming voluntary organizations and social clubs, we often think, we are tempted to think of the church as just being one more. And it is not that. It is the body of Christ. It has a monumentally important and specialized task. Now, and one of the things we must understand, and this is where Calvinism has really hurt the church. Calvinism, is this theology, which has dominated so much of Protestantism, says, in effect, that the church is a group of people who are directly led by the Spirit into everything important. Directly led, which means that we can sort of approach this whole thing devotionally, and the job will get done. Now, there's an element of truth in this, but when isolated, it is false, because Christianity is not a prayer meeting primarily. It's a classroom primarily. It's a classroom. Christianity, if you want to think of it in these terms, use this metaphor, is not a prayer meeting where they have a little bit of teaching. It's a classroom in which prayer takes place. And now, if you just want to see this, look at Jesus. What title did Jesus take? First title he ever used, human title, Rabbi, which means what? My teacher. And what were his followers called? Disciple, which means what? Students. And what Jesus and the apostles did for those 3.5 years was they had a college. That's how you had a college in those days. You find a teacher that, whether it was religious or non-religious, if you respected, you would go spend part of the year with him. You'd go live with him, if you could, travel with him, talk, and he would lecture, and you would ask questions. For instance, in Aristotle, in his peripatetic school, because he walked a lot, the walkers, Plato had schools like that. It's the way they did it. You understand? That the apostles, what Jesus and the apostles were doing traveling around, they were having a college, as you had college in those days. That's why, some critics said, the Bible contradicts itself because it records several callings of the disciples. Everyone's going to go calling them. Well, that's a piece of ignorance. What was happening was that they could not spend the whole year. He had to make a living. And so what they would do is Jesus would gather them. He initially gathered his students, weeded them out, and then he began to travel and teach them. And then he would send them out. We call an internship. Send them out two by two. Why? Because he sent them out into Perea and Galilee and Judea. Why? Because the day was going to come when he was going to send them into the whole world. He'd get them ready. And then they'd have to go fish for a while or earn their living. And he'd go rest. And then he'd round them up again. Say, okay, it's time to, summer session's over, vacation's over. it's time to get back to work. So he'd go and call them around there and say, let's go, you know. And they'd travel for a while, and he'd teach them. And then they'd go back and rest and do their, take care of business, and he'd round them up again. See what I'm saying? Time for school to start again, or he'd agree to meet them. See what I'm saying? Now, and look how Paul did. Paul says to the Ephesian elders, over 3 years I taught you daily and in the synagogue and from house to house, publicly and from house to house, and now it's your job. Note this, that Paul spent the same amount of time teaching the Ephesian elders that Jesus spent teaching the disciples for over 3 years. That is the time it took. Christianity is a taught religion. Christianity is not a simple religion. It is simple to learn how to become a Christian. And the basic Christian life is a simple thing. If anybody thinks Christianity is simple, never read the book of Romans. Peter referred to the writings of Paul, and he says, some of these things are hard to understand. And he's an apostle. Therefore, you just go through the New Testament, and you will see very clearly that Christianity is a taught religion. Therefore, the leaders of Christianity have to know their stuff. They have to be teachers. An elder has to be apt to teach. And that's self-evident. They are to be, the word poistemi is used, which means caretaker or superintendent, used several times. It's very close to overseer. One who, again, has charge, who has authority and responsibility. Not, by the way, when it says that the church is to be submissive to the elders, it's not the word slavery. It's a milder word, which means sort of like, it's not the relationship between a church member and the elder. It's not the relationship between in the first century figures, between a slave and his master. It's the relationship between a son and a father. See, it's a different kind of relationship. But the elder still is responsible. And then the word leader, he should be a leader. That's seven, and I think that's enough. But, you know, all these words are used to describe. Now, let me go on. Any questions? Well, I'm trying to get to this material, but I don't want to run roughshod over any questions about it. Yes? Well, and that is exactly the situation in many churches. That's the way it often works out. I'll just give you an opinion on that. I think that, number one, it ought not to occupy his time. At least not permanently. By that I mean, I think the preacher's primary job is to be teacher. It does not mean he will not be shepherd and sick calls and do counseling and things like that. But many preachers have their ministries ruined because they end up being counselors. In fact, if I went back into a local ministry now, I'd spend a lot less time in counseling than I was spending when I left the local ministry. Simple reason that I was young and I kind of got... I found this, that if people did not do what I said they ought to do when I said it from the pulpit, they didn't do it when I said it in the office. I would do most of my counseling from the pulpit. And if people had serious problems, I'd send them to a professional as I often did. And the preacher will always do a lot of pastoring. But the congregation needs to be taught, and the leaders need to be taught and prepared for this, that most of the pastoring should be done by the elders, leaving the preacher free to teach. Remember, this was what Paul said there in the early church. They were to pick these seven men. We often call them deacons. We may spend our time with the Word of God in prayer, and I think that is something of a precedent. Okay, so first of all, to answer your question, I think that if a congregation grows in maturity, the preacher will be expected to do less pastoring and more teaching, and the elders do take on that load. It's their job. Now you say, well, many elders, unless they're retired, they don't have time for it. You realize the elders in the first century, at least many of them, were paid elders. And I was working. We talked about restoring the New Testament church. We've never restored that. I was on the way. I think we just about had it. The church I served when I left, we were only about 300. And the only staff we had was me, a weekend youth minister, and a part-time secretary. There were churches in our area that had half as many people and twice the staff. Well, the reason we could get by with very little staff, we had very little staff and sent all of our money to missions. About 30% to 40% of our income to missions. The reason we could do that is we had a group of elders who did their job. They didn't need two or three preachers on the staff. Now, but it was a burden to them. And it was getting to the place where the church was growing. It was getting to the place where, well, a man works 8 or 10 hours in the job, he's tired when he comes home. You know, and how much time can he spend? And he's his family, he has to take care of his family and his house. I had suggested, they were thinking it over, they didn't ever do it, when I left that church, that we pick out, rather than hire, they said, well, you need to hire more staff. I said, let's not do that. Rather than hire staff, let's take one of these men, and I had a couple in mind, who had proven themselves over the years, knew the congregation, let's hire them. Let them quit their job, let's hire them, what the first century church did, and let them be full-time pastors, shepherds. You understand? Man, he knows the church, people respect him. He's been there for years, done it for nothing, so that then he can take some of the load off the other men who have to earn a living. Does that make sense to you? Or just share the burden. So we'll pay his salary and let him quit the one guy I had in mind was working in a factory, and he just spent all his time shepherding, dealing with people, because he's a very wise man. And they were thinking about it. I think if I'd have stayed there, they'd have done it. You see what I'm saying? So there are many ways to do this. And it's not easy. But in general, this is the way it should be. Now, the other answer to the question is, and I hope I'm getting it, in some congregations, elect the elder elect the minister as an elder. I know many churches where the minister is simply voted in as an elder as well as he becomes a preaching elder. In that case, he is a pastor. He's not the pastor. He's one of the pastors. He happens to be the preaching elder. And I see nothing wrong with that. I kind of like that. If the congregation, often that's done when the eldership is just beginning to grow, they need another elder. And then, now he has that relationship. Now, that could raise some problems if there's a conflict between the general eldership and his views on something. That could fit and has created problems. But, therefore, that requires a lot of, a group of men who are very mature, and often it works very well. So I think he ought to be considered a pastor if he's been elected to the eldership. Otherwise, he's something of an evangelist or a preacher. And they sound legalistic. For instance, you get a young man starting out in the ministry, 25 years old, got no business being an elder, elected to the eldership. See, he needs the wisdom of the elders to guide him. You get a man 40 and 50, been in the ministry for years, and there's a need, and he's qualified, and the church wants to do it. I see no problem with it. In fact, Peter talks about the elder. He calls himself, he's an apostle. He says, I'm a fellow elder. But the office of elder was incorporated, and all the offices were incorporated in the office of apostle. And he's glad to wear that title himself, Peter. Fellow elder. So that, my opinion, where it would work, I think it's fine. Did I get it what you were getting at? Perhaps I didn't. Now, some fake preachers, you're exactly right, and I don't think the name is all that important. I'd never raise a stink over, raise a big fuss over the name. Some preachers I know, they don't really want to be evangelists. They want to be pastors, so they'll take that name. Well, I think their mistake is that they don't really know what their job is. And so that would be a different situation than what I described before. But it's just like this. Just because a man is a preacher or evangelist doesn't mean he won't do a lot of pastoring. Just like we had elders who preached. When I left, by the way, I don't mean to hurt your feelings, but the church where I preached would never have thought about having an outside preacher come in when the pulpit was vacant, preacher on vacation. We had about six or eight different men with your preacher hat off. Good stuff. Now, they weren't great pulpit artists. You know, they weren't real polished at their pulpit work like a man is who preaches week after, you know, sometimes is. He preaches week after week after week. But they, when they got up the street, boy, they had something to say. So that didn't make them evangelists. You know, I'm not sure, Virgil, whether that title where, it's like there are many names. I said there's no one name given to the office of elder. Different names are given. I'm not convinced that term evangelist was called an official name anyway. I think that was an adjective. Or to describe the man, and I think perhaps this is what you're suggesting, that a man who insists that that's an exclusive title and that's his official title, I don't think you can show that in the scriptures. I think that's being too, I think that's being too legalistic in my opinion. Yes, ma'am. Yes. Yes. And that is the result of not being taught. And it's the result of not having some churches, not having men say really to say. Now, some people grow up in denominational churches where the man is the pastor, and that's the way it works. And it's a matter of growth. And it doesn't mean, for instance, it doesn't mean the minister would not do that. I know many cases where we had somebody who was having a continuing problem. I might look in on them and give what advice I could, but the general problem was taken care of by one of the elders. Doesn't mean the preacher is not that, but I know you're right. Some people, if they learn that this is the way it works, they'll accept it. But many people, especially in our churches, just as much as anybody else, we think, well, if the preacher doesn't come, you know, I've had people, you know, they get an ingrown toenail. They want the preacher there holding their hand. Some even play hide and seek with the preacher. I had one lady, church when I first went, she thought it was a great trick if she could get in the hospital and get out, and me not find out about it. You know, and about the third time she did that, I said, lady, I quit playing hide and seek when I was 15 years old. That was my last time. I didn't tell you sex. No, I didn't tell him playing with you. You want to play hide and seek, go play with somebody else. You know, that's the work of the church is too important for that. One more thing. We got 5 minutes. And I had a third thing. I want to get into duties. I don't have time to get into that. I do want to raise the question because I know it is controversial, and it's tough because the Bible does not explain this. What selection process is being used, should be used, to have elders? Well, now I know that the congregation is to vote, it's to approve. This is, the Bible's very clear about this, and the early church did it. The question is, who prepares the slate of candidates? Now, two basic ways this is done, and I've had experience in both. One is sort of general nominations from the floor. Anybody who is nominated is voted on. The second, and that's often done in social clubs or civic organizations. The other way is to have a nominating committee which takes suggestions, but then ultimately decides who will be put forward and who will not be. Now the first seems more democratic, and it is more democratic. The problem is the church is not a democracy. And now there are dangers in both. There are abuses of both. You know, with me? Just nomination, where anybody nominated gets voted on. Now, the church I served for a number of years, the nominating committee was the elders and the preacher. And it worked very well because the congregation respected the elders. I was in a couple of churches where we had nominations from the floor. And the experience of most preachers is that eventually doesn't work. I'll tell you, and I'll give you an opinion. This is opinion. It doesn't mean I'm right. The Bible doesn't explain this. Understand? This is not Bible. But I recommend, and I think this is the way you have it here, I recommend having a select nominating committee. Maybe not just elders, but primarily the elders. Maybe somebody they would choose to work with them. For this reason, first of all, in most congregations, especially a congregation that's growing, you will have and should have at any given time quite a number of people who are new. Now, they might be new Christians, understand? Or they might just simply be new in the church. Well, you see, a person who is new is really not in a position. They might nominate somebody, but you see, they might nominate somebody who's not qualified because they're a new Christian and they do not understand what's involved. Or they might nominate somebody who is really shouldn't be nominated, who they do not know, understand? They don't know them well enough. One known them for a year or so. See what I'm saying? And if the congregation is really growing, often the new people can outvote the more experienced ones. So you'd have people being put forth and voted on by people who really are not in a position to do it, either because they're new Christians or because they're new in the community, in a church, or both. And I've seen that happen. Secondly, it's my opinion that when you have anybody who's nominated voted on, no selection, no screening, that very often personalities overcome qualifications. You see, because a person is a good fellow and a good friend does not make him a good leader in the church. And we are all human. I am. If I have a friend, somebody I like, I tend to overlook his faults and really emphasize his good points. And I'm not questioning anybody's motives. I'm simply saying human nature being what it is. And I've seen this happen. And I know many, many churches where it has happened. Where you get a group of men who are nice fellows, but who are not elders. And elders are more specialized jobs. The third reason why I recommend, this is very important. I like the idea, the method of having a small, the elders be the heart at least of the nominating, of those who prepare the slate, is that I've always seen this true, that in every church I've ever worked with, that the elders were privy to information that was not available to the whole church and could not be made available for all kinds of reasons. And I have seen situation after situation where the elders really took it on the chin. This happened to us in Hamilton, because they would not put a man's name on the slate. There might be a four or five people who would want him on there, but they knew something that they, for all kinds of reasons, could not or would not share, make public. And you see, leaders in the church end up dealing with delicate problems, end up dealing with all kinds of things. Often they can't tell everything they know. All they can do is keep their mouth shut, and people don't understand. But that's better than having, I think, just general anybody's name put forward, put on the slate. Now, the last thing I would say is, so for those three reasons, I think you've got a good method, and that can be abused. Yet the common accusation is, well, it feeds on itself. And they just keep the leadership in a tight circle, and that can happen. That's a legitimate criticism. But you see, you've got to trust someone. And I think wisdom dictates, in the long run, it's better to trust the wisdom of a group of leaders who presumably have at least a certain amount of respect to the congregation, a certain amount of experience, than to trust the sort of the popular wisdom of people who maybe don't know the people or do not really understand what's involved in the eldership or don't really know the man, don't really know what's going on. And I recommend this to you on the basis of the fact that of my own experience. Now, it doesn't mean I'm right. And I've talked to many preachers. I have never met a preacher, maybe there are some around, who's been in the ministry very long, who was not absolutely opposed to having just any man whose name is put forward put on the slate for elder or deacon, because it's always caught up with them. It really weakens the church in the long run. Now, that's just my thinking on the subject. Like I said, the Bible doesn't say. But I think, in other words, if I ever became your minister and you asked me the question, you know, should we change the way we nominate our men, I would say no. I think you're doing it the right way. Now, the elders, I would say this, the elders might want to, the way we did it, every year when it came to nominating, the elders controlled it, but they would pick certain, they would have had a woman on it. You know, one of the leaders, and like maybe the head of the ladies' fellowship or something, try to get a few people to help us, to broaden our thinking, give us different perspectives. So the elders can, you know, you stand, they can widen their own circle, and I think they ought to. But it'd be up to them. And maybe because you need a woman's viewpoint, for instance. Women see things that men don't see, and so forth. But still, that is not the same thing as just throwing it open and let anybody whose name comes up. And that's just, you have a question on that? Yes. Not ballots, no. when people submitted names, we always wanted to know who submitted them. And what we did, and I did, I said the elders worked this out. What they would say is, if you think somebody, if you want us to, they would say when it came time to nominate, and I'm just about finished though. One of the elders would get up and announce to the church, "We're the next few weeks we're going to be considering names for the slate for next year. And we want you, if you have suggestions," we didn't call them nominations, "we want them, but we want them in writing, and we want you to submit with us the reasons why you think this man, you want us to consider this man." Because they, you know, they said give him a name, and it might be very good reasons. And sometimes they pick these men on the basis of these reasons given. Understand, that's some good suggestions. But it was not anonymous. And of course, the vote is anonymous, obviously. But we wanted to know why you think he would be a good, and we learned a great deal from that. For that reason only, not because we're trying to, that they were trying to, pick out people and say, well, you know, get them for further, we want to make their name later on. Understand what I'm saying? For that reason. Now, that's just a judgment call. That's purely a matter of judgment. There might be, listen to me, any system can be abused. If you've got good men, this kind of system will work. If you don't have good men, no system will work. You understand that? It's like a marriage. You can draw up a good legal arrangement, that won't make it work. If you've got love and wisdom, a marriage will work. If you don't, it ain't gonna work. And you can draw up whatever rules you want, or procedures you want. That's sort of the way it is. Thank you very much. I'm over time.